John, who's going to talk to Will, the head of global development for cricket, the International Cricket Council. Over to you, John.
Thank you very much indeed, David.
It's a pleasure.
Proper name.
Yes. Yep.
Absolutely. Well, lovely to meet you. Thank you very much for being in attendance. We've got a select few of us this evening. What time is it in Dubai?
Not too. So firstly, thank you, John. Wonderful to be joining all of you. It's quite reasonable now. It's still, 9:15. I apologise in advance for any background noise. The kids who should be in bed... still up, and so I apologise in advance for any noise interference. But wonderful to be with you and your members, and looking forward to having a chat.
Lovely, thank you. Ironically, the kids thing was, I was having a conversation with a videographer earlier on, and she was having an issue with a four-legged friend who wouldn't leave the room that she was trying to do some recording in. And I went, well, I have similar issues whenever I do things like this, or whenever me and Dave record on the radio, or if I'm recording any training. Inherently, I'll just get the kids wandering in, even though they've been explicitly told not to come in. It's, you know.
Yeah, I think I've got one of those four-legged fiends. I think if something's come out of the last couple of years, it's a tolerance for disruptions during video conferences and the like.
Yes.
We've seen what can go wrong and what can go horribly wrong in some cases. So if it's just a kid's interruption or a dog interruption, that's the least of our concerns, I'm sure.
Absolutely. I think you're right. We've all become quite accustomed to that. You know, once upon a time, it was like, that's it. You're it. After this is done, now it's like, oh, sorry. Yeah. And everyone's kind of cool about it. It's all good. As I say, thanks ever so much for joining us. I suppose I think the easiest question to kick it all off with is, where did your journey start? Because you've had quite a career to where you currently are. You know, don't know what's going to happen next, do we? So, you know, so where did the journey start for you?
Yeah, good question, John. I mean, I've been lucky. I've worked for some amazing organizations, been fortunate to travel to some incredible countries, and I've seen some of the countries that you and your members work in, so I'm sure you can understand and appreciate that, but you feel very fortunate to work A, in sport, and B, in a role that takes you to some countries that shows the power of sport and not only around health outcomes, but more relevantly, I think, the community development outcomes. So it's an accidental journey for me, as many of our careers have been, I'm sure. I grew up in Australia playing sport, never at any great level, a weekend warrior in rugby and cricket, rugby in the winter and cricket in the summer, which is a very traditional, I guess, approach in Australia. Then went to university to study graphic design, actually. Only to get kicked out after my first year on account of not being able to draw, funnily enough, which probably should have come out in the application process, but didn't. I grew up in Sydney. I was in Canberra, which is about 300 kilometres south of Sydney, for university, and was loving it. I was really enjoying Canberra. I was enjoying uni life and wanted to stay there. So I was desperate to find another degree that would keep me where I was and at uni for a few more years. And that was around about the time that Sydney was awarded the Olympics. I think around sort of 92, 93, I think they were awarded the Sydney Olympics. And the Australian Institute of Sport, which was based in Canberra, had forged a relationship with the University of Canberra, which is where I was studying. And anyway, long story short, they had introduced a number of sports degrees, sports coaching, sports administration, sports science, and I went down the administration route. I'd like to say, for reasons that were noble, but actually the rumour was that it was an incredibly easy degree because it was a new one and they were still finding their feet as to how to structure it. And I thought it would be the path of least resistance to getting a degree. And that's the one I chose. Completed a sports administration degree. From there, as I said, there was a real energy in Australian sport at the time in the lead up to the Sydney Olympics. The Australian Institute of Sport were recruiting madly to help prepare athletes for the games, but also the legacy of the impact of the games within the sort of sporting community, what was going to be the sporting legacy for hosting the Sydney Games afterwards. So I was lucky to get a job at the Australian Institute of Sport, the Australian Sports Commission from uni, and the rest, they say, is history. I landed in sport, and that first job was in the sort of international sport arena. I was working in a program that managed scholarships for Pacific Island, African and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander athletes in the lead up to the Sydney Games. So was fortunate to start in that sort of international space, and I've been there ever since.
It's an interesting, because I was doing, obviously, to do these types of things, I have to go away and do some reading on certain things. I think that if my memory says right, please do correct me if I'm wrong, but sort of the Australian Sports Commission founded 1985-ish, give or take?
Yeah, that's maybe, right. I think it was, that sounds about right. I think it opened in 1988, so probably founded in 90, that sounds about right.
So what prompted that? Because I kind of look at, like, from today going back to probably around about the late 90s, there just seems to, from that point and the introduction of the Australian Sports Commission, or whatever it was named before, I can't remember, there seems to have been just like an explosion of prime athletes of multiple sports that have come out of Australia that seem to be heavily linked to the Sports Commission.
Yeah, so again, it's a good question. What prompted it was it started back at the 1976 Olympic Games in Montreal, and that was, I think, the first Games that Australia didn't win a gold medal at, or at least was one of the worst performances that Australia had turned in at an Olympic Games. Mm. But they won no gold medals, and the story goes that the team, upon arrival back in Australia, were met and greeted by government dignitaries, and the feedback from the athletes was quite critical and focused on the need for the government to better support and better prepare the athletes for an Olympic Games, and that in effect was the catalyst for the establishment of the Australian Institute of Sport, which was managed by the Australian Sports Commission. So the Australian Sports Commission is the statutory authority in Australia that manages all of Australia's sports policy. And then the Australian Institute of Sport was set up to focus primarily on the preparation of elite athletes. And so, to answer your question, it was the 1976 Montreal Games was the catalyst for it. I think the campus itself, which started in Canberra, but has and still has satellite campuses in a number of cities around throughout Australia, depending on the sport, opened, I think, in 1988. And, yeah, the rest is history. I mean, it has been a very successful program, one that's been modelled by a number of countries around the world and, much to our frustration, has been surpassed. But I guess, you know, success has many fathers, and the likes of your system in the UK, Japan, and countries up in Europe have drawn inspiration from the AIS model, made it better, and have, you know, ultimately improved the competitiveness, I guess, of international sport.
I agree. I think that, you know, I go back to what I was saying before, which is ultimately the Sports Commission and everything that, you know, that has been born out of that over in its infancy, sort of, you know, the late 90s and moving through. So sort of, I just, you look at some of the sports people that have come through that And that is just phenomenal, because, and then from that, like you say, you know, you've got other countries that have kind of gone, yeah, we'll nick that bit, and we'll just borrow the whole lot, and we'll create something of our own. And I think that what you did there is superb, because you were with them a while, weren't you?
Yeah, I was there about 8 years, and look, I think you're right. What they did, in my opinion, what they did well, and what they weren't afraid to achieve that success. And you're right, a very successful program that turned out, you know, a number of once in a generation athletes that not only excelled in Australia but globally. I think a big element of that success was their willingness and eagerness to find the coaching expertise from overseas. There wasn't at the time a requirement or a demand or necessity information to Australian coaches. Gymnastics coaches came in from China, rowing coaches came in from Eastern Europe, and it was that willingness, I guess, to accept that you know what you don't know, and find and bring in that coaching expertise, which really created a culture of excellence at the AIS.
That can't have been an easy decision. To do that, because it was a brave move anyway to put that into context and start moving forwards, but then to sort of go, right, we don't know enough, we've now got to bring in talent, but no, not on top of that, we've got to bring in talent that you know aren't in country, they're overseas, we need to bring those talented individuals in. That's got to be probably one of the bravest decisions, from a sports perspective. How do you know how that came about? Or
No. Look, I don't. But I'd agree with you. I'd imagine it was a difficult policy decision, not only from the sort of parochialism, which I'm sure existed, particularly in the lead up to a home Olympic Games, yeah, but also, you know, a cultural perspective. And I think we've seen, both good and bad examples over, you know, in recent years of how a good and a bad culture can enhance or erode a sport. And when you effectively import a system from another country to sports program, and it comes with just so rounded all in terms of and that measure being the home country's performance at the games. Mm. And I suspect that drove part of that decision making process, but it wouldn't have been easy, you're right. But and credit where it's due, they stuck with it, and I think the results speak for themselves.
Absolutely, no, I agree, you're absolutely right. The results do sort of stack up. What tempted you away from, because obviously, you know, after a good few years, you're fully embedded in there. What tempted you away? Was it you driving it, or did somebody sort of dangle the carrot and you go, right, okay.
Yeah. No, look,
in the nicest
rugby is a sport. Yeah. Look, it was an amazing job. I think within my sort of 8 years at the Sports Commission, I was lucky to do work on a couple of fantastic projects. One was a secondment to the Sydney Olympics. I worked there for a year, so I actually worked with the organising committee for the Olympic Games. And that was an amazing experience to, having worked for the previous sort of 6 years in assisting Pacific Island African and Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander athletes prepare for the games, to then be able to work at the coalface of an Olympic Games and see the culmination of that work by watching those athletes compete and helping them compete was really satisfying. And I think for anyone who's worked at a major event, be it an Olympic Games, be it a national championships or world championships, they're incredibly exciting projects to work on. They're hard work, but they're great fun and they're very rewarding. And I was fortunate to have that opportunity. Likewise. I think it was by the IOC and the UN to work on the sports program of the East Timor sports transition, or sorry, the East Timor independence celebration. So once East Timor gained independence, the United Nations Transitional Administration have set up celebrate that independence to Condadova for a year. And again, incredibly rewarding work, very different to a sort of major event. But, you know, as you and your members would know better than me, being able to work on a project where you are focally on the grassroots and the establishment of structures that allow grassroots sports to take place was just a wonderful experience. I would have happily done that for much longer. And I guess to answer your question, having worked on a couple of those projects and larger sort of experiences, I guess I got to the stage where I wanted to see where else I could push myself and what other opportunities were out there. And purely by chance, and I wasn't necessarily looking for another job at that time, that advertised for a general manager for the Pacific Islands. And for anyone who knows rugby, the Pacific Islands has a huge rugby heritage, and it just felt like a really exciting project to work on the growth of a game in countries where that sport is so entrenched in the culture of a society. Just felt like a really fun and exciting project to work on. It was a newly established role, so I felt there was an opportunity to be creative in it.
Yeah.
And work in a sport that you love. And yeah. And so all of those sort of stars aligned for what became the next stage of my career, which was 10 years working at World Rugby.
For me, what I was going to say to you is that I don't know whether I'm astonished or not, but I'm more curious, I think, because I use the word entrenched, as to how entrenched rugby is within the Pacific Islands. How did that come about? Why is it so prolific? Because they create some amazing rugby players.
Yeah. Yeah, they really do. And look, you're right. It's it is entrenched. It's part of the culture, I guess. The comparison would be football in the UK, football in Brazil, or South America, general football everywhere.
Mm.
Look, it's a sport.
Is everybody struggling to hear, Will?
Mm. It keeps breaking up, and I thought it might be me.
They are big and hits them. And
Well, sorry, we seem to be losing you, the connection a bit. We're kind of losing big chunks of what you're saying, so apologies. Everybody switch the camera off to try and help the
the band. Sorry, Dan.
I apologise. It's just one of those techie things, isn't it?
Yeah, apologies. Do you want me to turn my camera off?
Can do, yeah.
Can do if that works. Right. Yeah, absolutely.
Sure. Now I've just got to work out how to do that. Here we go. All right. Hopefully that...
that might work.
Hopefully that helps.
Yeah.
So we were the question was, why do I think rugby is so entrenched in the Pacific Islands. It was introduced by the missionaries over 100 years ago. They're a fit, fast, big race that are well suited to a contact sport, and they're very good at it. And I guess that's a big part of it.
Yeah, I mean, because the role that you had there, sort of, that went from sort of the Oceania into Asia, were there many obstacles that you had to overcome over that sort of that 10-year period?
Professionally or with the game?
With the game, and you know, if you can link that professionally, then great.
Well, actually, look, I think whenever you and I'd been fortunate to have worked previously in the Pacific Islands, I was fairly familiar with the culture of it. But I think, again, and as you and your members would know, to be successful in anything, in any sphere of life, really, you do need to understand and respect the cultures in which you work. And I think you also need to, I mean, you used the word curious before, John, and I think that's spot on. You have to be incredibly curious, because the temptation is to be the person that can fix everything. But to be effective in that, you need to understand the problem, and that is often far more complex than what you might think it is, particularly when you're going into a when you haven't grown up in a particular culture. So I think that was absolutely a big challenge from a sort of professional perspective. And then if you look at the challenges from the sports perspective, I mean, it's the Pacific Islands are developing countries. They're competing against countries that have far more well-resourced or better-resourced rugby programs and sports infrastructure generally. And even a lot of the stuff that, you know, we might take for granted in the UK or in Australia around sort of basic, or what we consider to be basic sort of training principles, like hydration, ice to assist with injuries, and all of that doesn't necessarily exist in all the countries in the world. So, you know, you have to first understand that, and then try and find a way to work around that. And there are ways to work around any of these problems. Money isn't always the solution, and I think Fiji have shown that in a rugby perspective, having won two gold medals and their women this year or last year winning, you know, the bronze. So there are ways around it, so long as you keep an open mind as to what the solutions are. And as you rightly pointed out, you know, just be curious about things and the environments in which you work.
I've not been curious since the day I was born, probably. It's just the way I'm wired.
That's a good trait, John. That's a good trait.
Well, I know I learn differently, and I know I develop differently, and not everybody's the same. It's interesting that you're sort of saying, you know, you can't go in and fix something until you actually need to understand what the situation is, or if there is actually a need to be fixed more than anything else. And the other part you were saying about, you know, it's that element of ingenuity where you know it is going around the subject matter. You know, we'll use the, you know, ice for, you know, sort of on sort of injuries and stuff like that. It's finding other alternatives, and you know, there are plenty of alternatives if you look for it. Because if you're not looking for it, you're not going to see it, are you?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think also to add to that, also being receptive to ideas that might come out of left field as well. I mean, just because someone doesn't have a degree or an education, a formal education, doesn't mean that they don't understand the problem as well as you do, and can offer a different perspective to how it's solved. Absolutely. And that was one of my big learnings, particularly in East Timor, but also working for World Rugby and spending so much time in the Pacific Islands.
So when, having had 10 years with real world rugby, and it seems, you know, that you've had two very good careers so far, you know, and that you've loved
each one. I've got some bosses that might argue with you on that point, John, but carry on. John, it's good for the ego.
You don't want to talk to any of my bosses, because I'm sure there'll be some that'll say exactly the same thing. So what tempted you away from world rugby, and what, you know, to talk to me a little bit about you know, your role now as the head of global development for the ICC?
Yeah, so again, I was enjoying, I love my work at World Rugby. Love the people I was working with in terms of obviously my colleagues, but also the countries and the people within the countries that I was working with. And again, I mean, it was, the timing was good around about the time that Fiji won the gold in Brazil. It just felt like a good time. It felt like a natural sort of closing point, having started in a role that was a newly created position. So in many respects, setting up a lot of the programs that contributed to that gold medal, which was something that everyone always felt Fiji could and should achieve, because you know, they were so good and have been consistently so good at sevens rugby, and for them to have achieved that at Brazil, it felt like which was incidentally Fiji's first ever gold medal at an Olympic Games. So it was big, not only from a rugby perspective, but for the country itself.
That's not too shabby to have on your CV, is it really, Will?
Well, I'd like to claim credit for it, John, but the ingredients were there in Fiji, and they had always had a very competitive sevens team. I guess
I always say with stuff like that, you can have all the right ingredients, it's how you put them together.
And I think, and that's what we focused on, John, was really more so creating an environment where they could pull it all together and pull it all together themselves. And look, we made some massive mistakes. You know, there's no doubt about it. And ultimately, the lesson for me, particularly around the sevens, where those raw ingredients were there, was actually just creating an environment where they could come up with the solutions themselves. And when they're, you know, very different to their 15s side, and for people who aren't familiar with rugby, sevens is the shorter version of the game, but there are two versions, there's 15s and sevens. Most of Fiji's 15-a-side team ply their trade. They play professional rugby overseas. So it's very difficult for them to bring their players back and prepare them for international competition when they only have them for a few weeks a year, which is very different to the system that happens in or exists with the likes of Australia, the UK, South Africa, France and the like. But with their sevens program, all of their players were locally based. They were all local players. So they had them 365 days a year. And so really it was just about working with Fiji Rugby to create an environment that would allow them to best prepare those sevens players that they had access to. And in many respects it was quite an easy job, because they did it. we just provided the funding really to help them achieve that. But look, it felt like a sort of natural conclusion. And again, purely by coincidence, the ICC had advertised this role that I'm in now, the head of global development. And I guess the attraction for me as a fan of cricket was, it's a sport that I always felt had Samoa, a similar situation in Samoa. It was just, I just felt it was a sport that had enormous potential that was still untapped. And I liked the idea of trying to steer that and correct it. So again, it was, you know, a normal application process and went through it, and fortunately came out as a preferred candidate. And yeah, 5 years later, I'm still here. They still like me.
You must be doing something well. You must be doing something right. I mean, so what? I know we've gone through, you know, 2 years of Bertie, quite a lot of difficulty, and I'm sure that has had an impact. And we'll touch on that in just a moment. But what is your role as the head of global development? What does that constitute, and what are you overseeing? Tell me a little bit about what you're doing there.
Yeah, so we, like all international federations, we make our money at Cricket World Cup or our World Cup, and then the profits that are made at that event are reinvested back into the game. The bulk of that money is invested back into what we call our full members, who are the 12 countries that play test cricket. Mm-hmm. And then another chunk of money is reinvested back into what we call our sort of emerging countries, our associate members, of which there are 94 around the world. And the development department manages that investment that we make in those 94 countries. And we invest that in four main areas, or with four objectives, I guess, in mind. The first is to get more boys and girls playing the game of cricket.
Yeah.
The second is to improve the competitiveness of international cricket. So those associate members that do qualify or are likely to qualify for men's or women's Cricket World Cup or T20 World Cup are as best prepared to be competitive at those tournaments as they can be. The third element is linked to the second one in international competitiveness, and that is that we run a suite of international competitions that our members compete in. And most of those are sort of pathway or qualification events for all of our World Cups, be they men's or women's 50 over T20 or under 19s, men's and women's. And then the fourth area, which is the sort of less sexy area, but arguably most important, is investing in fit for purpose and strong member federations. All of the investment that we make in the growth of the game is made through our members. We're a member organisation, and we're only going to succeed in those four or those three objectives if our members are achieving their full potential. So that looks like staff professional development training programs, governance education programs, commercial development programs, and the like. It's all about investing in the member to be to achieve their potential.
Mm-hmm. And how much of an impact sort of over the 2 years when nobody really did anything other than sit in their own house, how much of an impact did that have on you? How much and the ICC with regards to your role in spreading the love for the game, getting more boys and girls playing, you know, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, so it's interesting, and I think COVID has definitely been, it has impacted the sport as it has all sports and all of society, not necessarily in a great way. I mean, even to this day, I think 55% of our members are still impacted by COVID in that they're unable to run their full capacity of programs. But there's no doubt that society and sport is returning to some mm-hmm. semblance of normality and cricket activity is resuming. But there's a legacy impact of that. And that's been a challenge. I think in some respects it's been a blessing in disguise for us as an international federation, or at least the development department with the international federation, because what was interesting, John, was our structure is such that we have five regional offices and through those regional offices, so one in Africa, Europe, East Asia Pacific, the Americas and Asia, and it's through those regional offices that manage the day-to-day relationship with each of our members. But all of a sudden, like everyone, our world was turned upside down that workforce who are normally traveling all around the world and delivering or helping members deliver school programs or coach education programs, all of a sudden weren't traveling. And so we had a decision, I guess, to make, and that was how, I mean, the question we asked ourselves is, in six, and no one knew it was going to last two years, but at the time we said, in 6 months' time, when this is all over, what are we going to have regretted not spending this time on? And we'd been working on a number of projects, particularly in the grassroots space, that because of time, because of cost, we hadn't been able to dive deeply into, that we decided now we're going to use this time to do that. So actually it was, you know, the last couple of years from a program development, program design perspective, it's been great because we've been able now to roll out a completely redesigned schools and community cricket program. We've developed a couple of new projects that we think, or we hope, and they're based on research, so we're confident, will assist the growth of women and girls cricket. We have we face a major challenge, as do most sports, but particularly in cricket, in attracting and retaining women and girls to our sport. So we've developed a program that we think is going to address that. Mm-hmm. Long story short, whilst the pandemic has absolutely impacted our members' ability to deliver cricket, and that's brought all sorts of challenges upon our members. And we were very conscious to maintain, and we've been lucky in that none of our major global events that generate the money have been, touch wood so far, impacted by the pandemic. So it hasn't affected our revenues in the same way that it has affected other sports or other leagues. So we've been able to maintain our funding to members, which is incredibly important. So whilst they weren't able to run cricket activity, they were shielded somewhat from the economic fallout on account of at least having the ICC funding. So, but from a program design perspective, it's been good because it's bought us the time to finalise some great projects that are all coming online now and set us up for what we hope is a really exciting 2022.
It's an interesting one because I've had this conversation with a number of other people within sort of, you know, large and smaller sort of organisations where they've used that period of time that was slightly longer than 6 months, obviously. if only, you know, where you've kind of been, and it sounds horrible when you say it, you've been given a unique opportunity to go back to the drawing board and just change things and adapt it and test it and roll something out knowing that it's going to work.
Yeah, that's exactly right. And I think it also bought us the time to just think as well, you know. And I think as we've all been on away days at work, and you always, whenever you finish those away days, you always think, oh, gee, we should do that more often because it's an opportunity to step away from, get out of the office, get away from the emails and the phone calls, and actually think about our work. And I think in many respects, COVID was, well, as it's turned out, not a 6 month, a 2 year away day that's really allowed us to think about our work. And and again, as I'm sure many of your members would appreciate, you know, a lot of the problems we're trying to solve, particularly in getting more people playing sport at the grassroots level, aren't actually sports problems, they're social problems. And so, you know, we needed to avoid the temptation to try and solve them as sports administrators and actually solve them as community members, as parents and as citizens, I guess. And that's, COVID brought us that time to think a little bit laterally about how we design our programs differently.
And it's one of the things, and Dave will probably attest to this in a little bit, it's one of the things that you know, it's why Dave, you know, brought about Koi Sports is that is to help out at local community levels, using sports as a vehicle. And, you know, ultimately, that's kind of what you're saying, really, is that, you know, if you can solve some of those social and sort of community issues, you won't be able to solve all of them just like that. It's going to take a little bit of time. I hope I'm intelligent enough to understand that. But it's helping out there so that, you know, boys and girls can play a sport that, you know, will get them fit and healthy, or at least out of the house.
Yeah, and that's all that matters, isn't it, John? I mean, it doesn't actually matter what sport they play. And I think this is going to be the great COVID revelation, is actually what we really need is just to keep our kids moving and get them moving again after COVID. And to do that, you've got to make your sport fun. And if that means that you're not necessarily teaching them how to hold a bat with the proper technique or bowl the ball, but actually just get them hitting and throwing and getting those motor skills moving, then that's a success. And if you can create a love of sport that creates a lifelong habit of physical activity, then I think we've done our job as sports administrators.
Well, I'd agree with you 100%. I've got a few questions that have come in whilst we've been having a little bit of a chat. So which of the organisations that you've worked for have you A, enjoyed the most, and B, been most proud of your achievements?
I can get into a lot of trouble answering that. Yeah. That's a load of questions.
So your current role.
Yeah. Look, without sounding trite, all of the roles have offered highlights that are difficult to separate on a sort of favourite moment, enjoyable moment scale. But I think if I was to be pushed for an answer, the work that I am most proud of and that I think I learnt the most from, it was the work in East Timor, because that was sport at its purest. It was a country that was emerging from the most horrific of circumstances, and for it to identify sport as one of the five pillars as the foundation of its celebration, I think tells us all that we need to know about sport. And to have been able to manage that project and work with people on that, I think that for me taught me the most about sport and is probably the work I'm most proud of.
Okay. Thank you. In the modern world, athletes are more accessible than ever, and we've seen a major rise in abuse of athletes. Do you think sports bodies and the wider community are doing enough to support them? And what do you think is the solution to this, or what can sporting bodies do to do more?
Yeah, so my first boss at the Australian Sports Commission was an Olympian, Dr. Jean Roberts, and the thing that she entrenched in me was the notion of that the athlete must always come first. And she held a view, probably still does, that too often as administrators we make decisions that don't always put the athlete first. So I think this is a very good question. I think sport only succeeds through athletes performing at the best of their ability, and that's at all levels of the game, be it at grassroots and a community sport right through to the elite level. So if you acknowledge and understand that, then you accept an obligation to ensure that you do everything you can to provide safe environments for athletes. And unfortunately, we still see today systematic problems that are, that suggest that that's not always the case. I think all sports have made huge improvements in this. And if we look at the work that, for example, rugby have done around concussion, you look around the work that the Olympic movement have done around safeguarding and child protection.
Yeah.
we're absolutely moving in the right direction. But the fact of the matter is, and the cold hard reality is that athlete welfare, whilst it, I am confident that it remains the priority of all sports, and I do genuinely believe that, the problems still exist, and that work, unfortunately, will never stop. I think the priority is to make sure that it stays at the top of our of all of our thinking.
I agree. So, just so we draw to a little bit of close, and to be honest with you, I could carry on chatting all night, but then I'm aware that now it's probably sort of 10.
Well, the kids still aren't asleep, John. So,
let's just keep chatting now. It's not gonna do that. what's next with the ICC? What should we keep an eye out for? What's going to sort of, you know, what's next for in your role? What's the next sort of big rollout, if you're allowed to tell us?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think we've sort of launched, but soft launched our what we're calling the CREO Cricket Program, which is our sort of grassroots and community program, and that's all about. So we will hope to do a formal launch around that at one of our upcoming events, be it the Men's T20 World Cup or the Men's World Cup next year, Men's T20 happening in Australia later this year. And that's the program that I was referring to earlier, that has been completely redesigned with, or designed, I should say, with kids, providing a fun first experience for kids, not necessarily a fun cricket experience. And I think it's an important distinction for the reasons that we talked about before. We, of course, as an international federation, we want kids to choose cricket and start a lifelong journey with our sport. They're only going to do that if they enjoy their their initial experience. And it's got to be fun and engaging. And we've put a lot of work into developing that so it doesn't look like a traditional mass participation program that you might see in other sports. It's much more a sort of games-based activities that introduce the concepts of cricket without necessarily drilling into them.
I love that.
Technique and the like. So that's the program I'm incredibly excited about. We'll be winding up over the course of this year, and I think our biggest challenge, our biggest opportunity, but also our biggest challenge, is attracting more women and girls and keeping more women and girls in our sport. And there are unfortunately a number of barriers that exist, particularly in cricket. Some are cricket specific, some are societal, that we need to address, and hopefully if we've done our work right, and we've partnered with organisations like the UN to make sure that we've explored everything, we can succeed in getting more kids, but particularly more women and girls playing our games. So that's what I'm excited about.
Yeah, and the one thing from my perspective is I just wanted to just say that, just as we add in here, is that here in the UK, I've seen specifically from seeing it on the TV, for example, a lot more women's cricket. There seems to be a huge drive for that participation in society as a whole. And I think if you correlate that with, you know, women's rugby and women's football, I love going to go and watch the Leicester City football, you know, when the ladies play. And I love being able to go and do that. I think the fact that you've embraced this and there's a big push on this from the kids' point of view, fun first, to creating, you know, more of a societal sort of look on and having sort of, is that diversification? Yeah, men's game is been around forever and creates a lot of money. Women's game is getting bigger and bigger and bigger, but you're only going to be able to keep that going if you've got the engagement to grassroots levels.
Yeah, you're right, and you're absolutely right. There is huge momentum behind women's sport. I think that's been driven particularly up in the UK, and credit where it's due. And I think campaigns like This Girl Can is just such a fantastic example for all of us around you know, how to engage and connect with, you know, with a market and a demographic. And we've drawn a lot of inspiration from that. So, and as our broadcast partner, Star, which is Star India, have told us, you know, investing in women's sport isn't, it's not just the right thing to do. It actually makes good business sense. And,
Absolutely. And
I think we're starting to see that. And it's, I think in that regard, it's, we're heading into a really exciting few years as that sort of latent demand for women's sport is realised.
Well, I for one, I'm going to be looking forward to this rollout over the rest of 2022. David's going to tell me off because we've overrun, but you know. I was having a good chat. For me, it's been an absolute honour and a privilege to talk to you. Thanks for staying up and thanks for the kids for being quiet as well. Well done.
<Yeah. laughs> No, John, thanks. Thank you. It's been, I'm flattered to be on it. I've looked at the work that you guys do and it's I feel privileged to have been able to have this chat.
Thank you, Will.
Very much indeed, Will. Thank you.
Been brilliant. Good. I've taken loads of notes.
Good.
That is good. Good. Thank you.